This is the job you came here to do. This is the joy of creating self, of knowing self, of becoming consciously what you wish to be. It is what is meant by being self-conscious. You have brought yourself to the relative world so that you might have the tools with which to know and experience who you really are. Who you are is who you create yourself to be in relationship to all the rest of it. Your personal relationships are the most important elements in this process. Your personal relationships are therefore holy ground. They have virtually nothing to do with the other, yet because they involve another, they have everything to do with the other. This is the divine dichotomy. This is the closed circle. So it is not such a radical teaching to say, blessed are the self-centered, for they shall know God. It might not be a bad goal in your life to know the highest part of yourself and to stay centered in that. Your first relationship, therefore, must be with yourself. You must first learn to honor and cherish and love yourself. You must first see yourself as worthy before you can see another as worthy. You must first see yourself as blessed before you can see another as blessed. You must first know yourself to be holy before you can acknowledge holiness in another. If you put the cart before the horse, as most religions ask you to do, and acknowledge another as holy before you acknowledge yourself, you will one day resent it. If there is one thing none of you can tolerate, it is someone being holier than thou. Yet your religions force you to call others holier than thou. And so you do it for a while, then you crucify them. You have crucified, in one way or another, all of my teachers, not just one. And you did so not because they were holier than thou, but because you made them out to be. My teachers have all come with the same message, not I am holier than thou, but you are as holy as am I. This is the message you have not been able to hear. This is the truth you have not been able to accept. And that is why you can never truly, purely fall in love with another. You have never truly, purely fallen in love with yourself. And so I tell you this. Be now and forever centered upon yourself. Look to see what you are being, doing, and having in any given moment, not what's going on with another. It is not in the action of another, but in your reaction that your salvation will be found.
Well, I know better, but somehow this makes it sound as though we should not mind what others do to us in relationship. I mean, like they can do anything, and so long as we hold our equilibrium, I guess, keep our self-centered and all that good stuff, nothing can touch us. But others do touch us, certainly touch me, and their actions sometimes hurt us. It's when the hurt comes into relationships that I don't know what to do. It's all very well to say, stand aside from it, cause it to mean nothing, but that's easier said than done. I do get hurt by the words and actions of others in relationships.
The day will come when you will not. That will be the day on which you realize and actualize the true meaning of relationships, the true reason for them. It is because you have forgotten this that you react the way you do. But that's all right. That's part of the growth process. It's part of evolution. It is soul work you are up to in relationship. And that is a grand understanding, a grand remembering. Until you remember this, and remember then also how to use relationship as a tool in the creation of self. You must work at the level at which you are, the level of understanding, the level of willingness, the level of remembrance. And so there are things you can do when you react with pain and hurt to what another is being, saying, or doing. The first is to admit honestly to yourself and to another exactly how you're feeling. This many of you are afraid to do because you think it'll make you look bad. Somewhere deep inside of you, you realize that it probably is ridiculous for you to feel that way. It probably is small of you. You are bigger than that, but you can't help it. You still feel that way. There's only one thing you can do. You must honor your feelings. For honoring your feelings means honoring yourself. And you must love your neighbor as you love yourself. How can you ever expect to understand and honor the feelings of another if you cannot honor the feelings within yourself? The first question in any interactive process with another is, now who am I and who do I want to be in relationship to that? Often you do not remember who you are and do not know who you want to be until you try out a few ways of being. That is why honoring your truest feelings is so important. If your first feeling is a negative feeling, simply having the feeling is frequently all that is needed to step away from it. It is when you have the anger, have the upset, have the disgust, have the rage, own the feeling of wanting to hurt back, that you can disown these first feelings as not who you want to be. The master is one who has lived through enough such experiences to know in advance what her final choices are. She does not need to try out anything. She's worn these clothes before and knows they do not fit. They are not her. And since a master's life is devoted to the constant realization of self as one knows oneself to be, such ill-fitting feelings would never be entertained. That is why masters are imperturbable in the face of what others might call calamity. A master blesses calamity, for the master knows that from the seeds of disaster and all experience comes the growth of self. And the master's second life purpose is always growth. For once one is fully self-realized, there is nothing left to do except be more of that. It is at this stage that one moves from soul work to God work, for this is what I am up to. I will assume, for the purposes of this discussion, that you are still up to soul work. You are still seeking to realize, make real, who you truly are. Life will give you bountiful opportunities to create that. Remember, life is not a process of discovery. Life is a process of creation. You can create who you are over and over again. Indeed, you do every day. As things now stand, you do not always come up with the same answer, however. Given an identical outer experience, on day one, you may choose to be patient, loving, and kind in relationship to it. On day two, you may choose to be angry, ugly, and sad. The master is one who always comes up with the same answer, and that answer is always the highest choice. In this, the master is imminently predictable. Conversely, the student is completely unpredictable. One can tell how one is doing on the road to mastery by simply noticing how predictably one makes the highest choice in responding or reacting to any situation. Of course, this throws open the question, what choice is highest? That's a question around which have revolved the philosophies and theologies of man since the beginning of time. If the question truly engages you, you are already on your way to mastery. For it is still true that most people continue to be engaged by another question altogether. Not what is the highest choice, but what is the most profitable? Or how can I lose the least? When life is lived from a standpoint of damage control or optimum advantage, the true benefit of life is forfeited. The opportunity is lost. The chance is missed. For a life lived thusly is a life lived with fear, and that life speaks a lie about you. For you are not fear. You are love. Love that needs no protection. Love that cannot be lost. Yet you will never know this in your experience if you continually answer the second question and not the first. For only a person who thinks there is something to gain or to lose asks the second question. And only a person who sees life in a different way, who sees self as a higher being, who understands that winning or losing is not the test, but only loving or failing to love. Only that person asks the first. He who asks the second question says, "I am my body." She who asks the first says, "I am my soul." Yea, let all those who have ears to hear listen. For I tell you this, at the critical juncture in all human relationships, there is only one question. What would love do now? No other question is relevant. No other question is meaningful. No other question has any importance to your soul. Now we come upon a very delicate point of interpretation. For this principle of love-sponsored action has been widely misunderstood. And it is this misunderstanding which has led to the resentments and angers of life, which in turn have caused so many to stray from the path. For centuries, you have been taught that love-sponsored action arises out of the choice to be, do, and have whatever produces the highest good for another. Yet I tell you this. The highest choice is that which produces the highest good for you. As with all profound spiritual truth, this statement opens itself to immediate misinterpretation. The mystery clears a bit the moment one decides what is the highest good one could do for oneself. And when the absolute highest choice is made, the mystery dissolves. The circle completes itself. And the highest good for you becomes the highest good for another. It may take lifetimes to understand this, and even more lifetimes to implement, for this truth revolves around an even greater one. What you do for yourself, you do for another. What you do for another, you do for the self. This is because you and the other are one, and this is because there is naught but you. All the masters who have walked your planet have taught this. Verily, verily, I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, ye have done it unto me. Yet this has remained for most people merely a grand esoteric truth, with little practical application. In fact, it is the most practically applicable esoteric truth of all time. It is important in relationships to remember this truth, for without it, relationships will be very difficult. Let's go back to the practical applications of this wisdom and step away from the purely spiritual, esoteric aspect of it for now. So often, under the old understandings, people, well-meaning and well-intentioned and many very religious, did what they thought would be best for the other person in their relationships. Sadly, all this produced in many cases, in most cases, was continued abuse by the other, continued mistreatment, continued dysfunction in the relationship. Ultimately, the person trying to do what is right by the other, to be quick to forgive, to show compassion, to continually look past certain problems and behaviors, becomes resentful, angry, and mistrusting, even of God. For how can a just God demand such unending suffering, joylessness, and sacrifice, even in the name of love? The answer is, God does not. God asks only that you include yourself among those you love. God goes further. God suggests, recommends, that you put yourself first. I do this knowing full well that some of you will call this blasphemy, and therefore not my word, and that others of you will do what might be even worse, accept it as my word and misinterpret it or distort it to suit your own purposes, to justify ungodly acts. I tell you this, putting yourself first in the highest sense never leads to an ungodly act. If, therefore, you have caught yourself in an ungodly act as a result of doing what is best for you, the confusion is not in having put yourself first, but rather in misunderstanding what is best for you. Of course, determining what is best for you will require you to also determine what it is you are trying to do. This is an important step that many people ignore. What are you up to? What is your purpose in life? Without answers to these questions, the matter of what is best in any given circumstances will remain a mystery. As a practical matter, again, leaving esoterics aside, if you look to what is best for you in these situations where you are being abused, at the very least, what you will do is to stop the abuse. And that will be good for both you and your abuser. For even an abuser is abused when his abuse is allowed to continue. This is not healing to the abuser, but damaging. For if the abuser finds that his abuse is acceptable, what does he learn? Yet if the abuser finds that his abuse will be accepted no more, what has he been allowed to discover? Therefore, treating others with love does not necessarily mean allowing others to do as they wish. Parents learn this early with children. Adults are not so quick to learn it with other adults, nor nation with nation. Yet despots cannot be allowed to flourish, but must be stopped in their despotism. Love of self
and love of the despot demands it. This is the answer to your question. If love is all there is, how can man ever justify war? Sometimes man must go to war to make the grandest statement about who man truly is, he who abhors war. There are times when you may have to give up who you are in order to be who you are. There are masters who have taught you cannot have it all until you are willing to give it all up. Thus, in order to have yourself as a man of peace, you may have to give up the idea of yourself as a man who never goes to war. History has called upon men for such decisions. The same is true in the most individual and the most personal relationships. Life may more than once call upon you to prove who you are by demonstrating an aspect of who you are not. This is not so difficult to understand if you have lived a few years, though for the idealistically young it may seem the ultimate contradiction. In more mature retrospection, it seems more divine dichotomy. This does not mean in human relationships that if you are being hurt, you have to hurt back. Nor does it mean so in relationships between nations. It simply means that to allow another to continually inflict damage may not be the most loving thing to do for yourself or the other. This should put to rest some pacifist theories that highest love requires no forceful response to what you consider evil. The discussion here turns esoteric once more, because no serious exploration of this statement can ignore the word evil and the value judgments it invites. In truth, there is nothing evil, only objective phenomena and experience. Yet your very purpose in life requires you to select from the growing collection of endless phenomena a scattered few which you call evil. For unless you do, you cannot call yourself nor anything else good, and thus cannot know or create yourself. By that which you call evil, do you define yourself? And by that which you call good? The biggest evil would therefore be to declare nothing evil at all. You exist in this life in the world of the relative, where one thing can exist only insofar as it relates to another. This is at one and the same time both the function and the purpose of relationship: to provide a field of experience within which you find yourself, define yourself, and if you choose, constantly recreate who you are. Choosing to be godlike does not mean you choose to be a martyr, and it certainly does not mean you choose to be a victim. On your way to mastery, when all possibility of hurt, damage, and loss is eliminated, It would be well to recognize hurt, damage, and loss as part of your experience and decide who you are in relationship to it. Yes, the things that others think, say, or do will sometimes hurt you until they do not anymore. What will get you from here to there most quickly is total honesty, being willing to assert, acknowledge, and declare exactly how you feel about a thing. Say your truth, kindly but fully and completely. Live your truth, gently but totally and consistently. Change your truth easily and quickly when your experience brings you new clarity. No one in right mind, least of all God, would tell you when you are hurt in a relationship to stand aside from it, cause it to mean nothing. If you are now hurting, it is too late to cause it to mean nothing. Your task now is to decide what it does mean and to demonstrate that. For in so doing, you choose and become who you seek to be.
So I don't have to be the long-suffering wife or the belittled husband or the victim of my relationships in order to render them holy or to make me pleasing in the eyes of God.
Good grief, of course not.
And I don't have to put up with attacks on my dignity, assaults on my pride, damage to my psyche, and wounds to my heart, in order to say that I gave it my best in a relationship, did my duty, or met my obligation in the eyes of God and man.
Not for 1 minute.
Well, then pray, God, tell me, what promises should I make in relationship? What agreements must I keep? What obligations do relationships carry? What guidelines should I seek?
The answer is the answer you cannot hear. For it leaves you without guidelines and renders null and void every agreement in the moment you make it. The answer is, you have no obligation, neither in relationship nor in all of life.
No obligation?
No obligation, nor any restriction or limitation, nor any guidelines or rules. Nor are you bound by any circumstances or situations, nor constrained by any code or law. Nor are you punishable for any offense, nor capable of any. For there is no such thing as being offensive in the eyes of God.
I've heard all this before, this there are no rules kind of religion. That's spiritual anarchy. I don't see how that can work.
There's no way it cannot work if you are about the business of creating yourself. If, on the other hand, you imagine yourself to be about the task of trying to be what someone else wants you to be, the absence of rules or guidelines might indeed make things difficult. Yet the thinking mind begs to ask, if God has a way she wants me to be, why didn't she simply create me that way to begin with? Why all this struggle for me to overcome who I am in order for me to become what God wants me to be? This the probing mind demands to know, and rightly so, for it is a proper inquiry. The religionists would have you believe that I created you as less than who I am so that you could have the chance to become as who I am, working against all odds, and I might add, against every natural tendency I am supposed to have given you. Among these so-called natural tendencies is the tendency to sin. You are taught that you were born in sin, that you will die in sin, and that to sin is your nature. One of your religions even teaches you that you can do nothing about this. Your own actions are irrelevant and meaningless. It is arrogant to think that by some action of yours you can get to heaven. There is only one way to heaven, salvation, and that is through no undertaking of your own, but through the grace granted you by God through acceptance of His Son as your intermediary. Once this is done, you are saved. Until it is done, nothing that you do, not the life you live, not the choices you make, not anything you undertake of your own will in an effort to improve yourself or render you worthy, has any effect, bears any influence. You are incapable of rendering yourself worthy because you are inherently unworthy. You were created that way. Why? God only knows. Perhaps he made a mistake. Perhaps he didn't get it right. Maybe he wishes he could have it all to do over again. But there it is. What to do?
You're making mock of me.
No. You are making mock of me. You're saying that I, God, made inherently imperfect beings, then have demanded of them to be perfect or face damnation. You are saying then that somewhere several thousand years into the world's experience, I relented, saying that from then on you didn't necessarily have to be good. You simply had to feel bad when you were not being good, and accept as your savior the one being who could always be perfect, thus satisfying my hunger for perfection. You are saying that my son, the one you claim to be the perfect one, has saved you from your own imperfection, the imperfection I gave you. In other words, God's son has saved you from what his father did. This is how you, many of you, say I've set it up. Now, who is mocking whom?
Well, this is the second time you seem to have launched a frontal attack on fundamentalist Christianity, and I'm surprised.
You have chosen the word attack. I am simply engaging the issue. And the issue, by the way, is not fundamentalist Christianity, as you put it. It is the entire nature of God and of God's relationship to man. The question comes up here because we were discussing the matter of obligations in relationships and in life itself. You cannot believe in an obligationless relationship because you cannot accept who and what you really are. You call a life of complete freedom spiritual anarchy. I call it God's great promise. It is only within the context of this promise that God's great plan can be completed. You have no obligation in relationship. You have only opportunity. Opportunity, not obligation, is the cornerstone of religion, the basis of all spirituality. So long as you see it the other way around, you will have missed the point. Relationship, your relationship to all things, was created as your perfect tool in the work of the soul. That is why all human relationships are sacred ground. It is why every personal relationship is holy. In this, many churches have it right. Marriage is a sacrament, but not because of its sacred obligations. Rather, because of its unequaled opportunity. Never do anything in relationship out of a sense of obligation. Do whatever you do out of a sense of the glorious opportunity your relationship affords you to decide and to be who you really are.
I can hear that. Yet over and over in my relationships, I have given up when the going gets tough. The result is I've had a string of relationships where I thought as a kid that I'd have only one. I don't seem to know what it's like to hold on to a relationship. You think I'll ever learn? What do I have to do to make it happen?
You make it sound as if holding on to a relationship means it's been a success. Try not to confuse longevity with a job well done. Remember, your job on the planet is not to see how long you can stay in relationship. It's to decide and experience who you really are. This is not an argument for short-term relationships, and neither is there a requirement for long-term ones. Still, while there is no such requirement, this much should be said. Long-term relationships do hold remarkable opportunities for mutual growth, mutual expression, and mutual fulfillment. That has its own reward.
I know. I mean, I've always suspected that. So how do I get there?
First, make sure you get into a relationship for the right reasons. I'm using the word right here as a relative term. I mean right relative to the larger purpose you hold in your life. As I have indicated before, most people still enter relationships for the wrong reasons. To end loneliness, fill a gap, bring themselves love or someone to love. And those are some of the better reasons. Others do so to salve their ego and their depressions, improve their sex life, recover from a previous relationship, or, believe it or not, to relieve boredom. None of these reasons will work. And unless something dramatic changes along the way, neither will the relationship.
I didn't enter into my relationships for any of those reasons.
I would challenge that. I don't think you know why you entered your relationships. I don't think you thought about it in this way. I don't think you entered your relationships purposefully. I think you entered your relationships because you fell in love.
That's exactly right.
And I don't think you stopped to look at why you fell in love. What was it to which you were responding? What need, a set of needs, was being fulfilled? For most people, love is a response to need fulfillment. Everyone has needs. You need this, another needs that. You both see in each other a chance for need fulfillment. So you agree, tacitly, to a trade. I'll trade you what I've got if you give me what you've got. It's a transaction. But you don't tell the truth about it. You don't say, I trade you very much. You say, I love you very much. And then the disappointment begins.
You've made this point before.
Yes, and you've done this thing before, not once, but several times.
You know, sometimes this dialogue seems to be going around in circles, making the same points over and over again.
Sort of like life.
Ooh, touché.
The process here is that you're asking the questions and I'm merely answering them. You ask the same question three different ways, I'm obliged to continue answering it.
Maybe I keep hoping you'll come up with a different answer. You take a lot of the romance out of it when I ask you about relationships. What's wrong with falling head over heels in love without having to think about it?
Nothing. Fall in love with as many people as you like that way. But if you're going to form a lifelong relationship with them, you may want to add a little thought. On the other hand, if you enjoy going through relationships like water, or worse yet, staying in one because you think you have to, then living a life of quiet desperation. If you enjoy repeating these patterns from your past, keep right on doing what you've been doing.
Okay, I get it. Well, you're relentless, aren't you?
That's the problem with truth. The truth is relentless. It won't leave you alone. It keeps creeping up on you from every side, showing you what's really so. That can be annoying.
Okay. So I want to find the tools for a long-term relationship, and you say entering relationships purposefully is one of them.
Yes. Be sure you and your mate agree on purpose. If you both agree at a conscious level that the purpose of your relationship is to create an opportunity, not an obligation, an opportunity for growth, for full self-expression, for lifting your lives to their highest potential, for healing every false thought or small idea you ever had about you, and for ultimate reunion with God through the communion of your two souls, if you take that vow instead of the vows you've been taking, the relationship has begun on a very good note. It's gotten off on the right foot. That's a very good beginning.
Still, it's no guarantee of success.
If you want guarantees in life, then you don't want life. You want rehearsals for a script that's already been written. Life, by its nature, cannot have guarantees. Its whole purpose is thwarted.
Okay, got it. So now I've got my relationship off to this very good start. Now how do I keep it going?
Know and understand that there will be challenges and difficult times. Don't try to avoid them. Welcome them gratefully. See them as grand gifts from God, glorious opportunities to do what you came into the relationship and life to do. Try very hard not to see your partner as the enemy or the opposition during these times. In fact, seek to see no one and nothing as the enemy or even the problem. Cultivate the technique of seeing all problems as opportunities. Opportunities to...
I know. Be and decide who you really are.
Right, you're getting it. You are getting it.
Sounds like a pretty dull life to me.
Then you're setting your sights too low. Broaden the scope of your horizons. Extend the depth of your vision. See more in you than you think there is to be seen. See more in your partner, too. You'll never disserve your relationship, nor anyone, by seeing more in another than they are showing you. For there is more there, much more. It is only their fear that stops them from showing you. If others notice that you see them as more, they will feel safe to show what you obviously already see.
People tend to live up to our expectations of them.
Something like that. I don't like the word expectations here. Expectations ruin relationships. Let's say that people tend to see in themselves what we see in them. The grander our vision, the grander their willingness to access and display the part of them we have shown them. Isn't that how all truly blessed relationships work? Isn't that part of the healing process, the process by which we give people permission to let go of every false thought they've ever had about themselves? Isn't that what I'm doing here for you?
Yes.
And that is the work of God. The work of the soul is to wake yourself up. The work of God is to wake everybody else up.
We do this by seeing others as who they are, by reminding them of who they are.
This you can do in two ways. By reminding them of who they are, very difficult because they will not believe you. And by remembering who you are, much easier, because you do not need their belief, only your own. Demonstrating this constantly ultimately reminds others of who they are, for they will see themselves in you. Many masters have been sent to the earth to demonstrate eternal truth. Others, such as John the Baptist, have been sent as messengers, telling of the truth in glowing terms, speaking of God with unmistakable clarity. These special messengers have been gifted with extraordinary insight and the very special power to see and receive eternal truth, plus the ability to communicate complex concepts in ways that can and will be understood by the masses. You are such a messenger.
I am?
Yes. You believe this?
Well, it's such a difficult thing to accept. I mean, all of us want to be special.
All of you are special.
And the ego gets in there, at least with me it does, and tries to make me feel somehow chosen for an amazing assignment. I have to fight that ego all the time, seek to purify and repurify my every thought, word, and deed so as to keep personal aggrandizement out of it. So it's very difficult to hear you say what you're saying because I'm aware that it plays to my ego, and I've spent my whole life fighting my ego.
I know you have, and sometimes not too successfully.
I am chagrined to have to agree.
Yet always when it has come to God, you have let the ego drop. Many is the night you have begged and pleaded for clarity, beseeched the heavens for insight, not so that you could enrich yourself or heap honor upon yourself, but out of the deep purity of a simple yearning to know.
Yes.
And you have promised me over and over again that should you be caused to know, you would spend the rest of your life, every waking moment, sharing eternal truth with others. Not out of a need to gain glory, but out of your heart's deepest desire to end the pain and suffering of others, to bring joy and gladness and help and healing, to reconnect others with the sense of partnership with God you have always experienced.
Yes, yes.
And so I have chosen you to be my messenger, you and many others. For now, during these times immediately ahead, the world will need many trumpets to sound the clarion call. The world will need many voices to speak the words of truth and healing for which millions long. The world will need many hearts joined together in the work of the soul, prepared to do the work of God. Can you honestly claim that you're not aware of this?
No.
Can you honestly deny that this is why you came?
No.
Are you ready then with this dialogue to decide and to declare your own eternal truth? To announce and articulate the glory of mine?
Must I include these last few exchanges?
You don't have to do anything. Remember, in our relationship, you have no obligation, only opportunity. Is this not the opportunity for which you have waited all your life? Have you not devoted yourself to this mission and the proper preparation for it from the earliest moments of youth?
Yes.
Then do not what you are obliged to do, but what you have an opportunity to do. It's including this exchange. Why would you not? Think you that I want you to be a messenger in secret?
No, I suppose not.
It takes great courage to announce oneself as a man of God. You understand the world will much more readily accept you as virtually anything else but a man of God, an actual messenger. Every one of my messengers has been defiled. Far from gaining glory, they've gained nothing but heartache. Are you willing? Does your heart ache to tell the truth about me? Are you willing to endure the ridicule of your fellow human being? Are you prepared to give up glory on earth for the greater glory of the soul fully realized?
You know, you're making this all sound suddenly pretty heavy, God.
You want I should kid you about it?
Well, we could lighten up just a little here.
Hey, I'm all for enlightenment. Why don't we start with a joke?
Good idea. You got one?
No, but you do. Tell the one about the little girl drawing a picture.
Oh, yes, that one. Okay, well, a mommy comes into the kitchen one day to find her little girl at the table, crayons everywhere, deeply concentrating on a freehand picture she is creating. Maya, what are you so busy drawing? The mommy asked. It's a picture of God, mommy, the beautiful girl replied, eyes shining. Oh, honey, that's so sweet, the mommy said, trying to be helpful. But you know, no one really knows what God looks like. Well, chirped the little girl,
If you'll just let me finish.
That's a beautiful little joke. You know what's most beautiful? The little girl never doubted that she knew exactly how to draw me.
Yes.
Now I'll tell you a story.
All right.
There once was a man who suddenly found himself spending hours each week working on a dialogue. Day after day, he would race to pad and pen, sometimes in the middle of the night, to capture each new inspiration. Finally, someone asked him what he was up to. Oh, he replied, I'm writing down a very long conversation I'm having with God. That's very sweet, his friend indulged him. But you know, no one really knows for sure what God would say. Well, the man grinned, if you'll just let me finish. You may think this is easy, this be who you really are business, but it's the most challenging thing you'll ever do in your life. In fact, you may never get there. Few people do, not in one lifetime, not in many.
So why try? Why enter the fray? Who needs it? Why not simply play life as if it were what it apparently is anyway, a simple exercise in meaninglessness, leading to nowhere in particular, a game you can't lose no matter how you play, a process that leads to the same result ultimately for everyone? You say there's no hell, there's no punishment, there's no way to lose, so why bother trying to win? What's the incentive, given how difficult it is to get where you say we're trying to go? Why not take our good-natured time and just relax about all this God stuff and being who you really are?
My, we are frustrated, aren't we?
Well, I get tired of trying, only to have you come in here and tell me how hard it's all going to be and how only one in a million makes it anyway.
Yes, I see that you do. Let me see if I can help. First, I'd like to point out that you already have taken your good-natured time about it. Do you think this is your first attempt at this?
I have no idea.
It doesn't seem as if you've been here before.
Well, sometimes.
Well, you have. Many times.
How many times?
Many times.
That's supposed to encourage me?
It's supposed to inspire you.
How so?
First, it takes the worry out of it. Brings in the can't-fail element you just talked about. It assures you that the intention is for you not to fail, that you'll get as many chances as you want and need. You can come back again and again and again. If you do get to the next step, if you evolve to the next level, it's because you want to, not because you have to. You don't have to do anything. You enjoy life at this level. If you feel that this is the ultimate for you, you can have this experience over and over and over again. In fact, you have had it over and over again for exactly that reason. You love the drama. You love the pain. You love the not knowing, the mystery, the suspense. You love it all. That's why you're here.
Are you kidding me?
Would I kid you about a thing like that?
I don't know. I don't know what God kids about.
Not about this. This is too close to the truth. Too close to ultimate knowing. I never kid about how it is. Too many people have played with your mind about that. I'm not here to get you more mixed up. I'm here to help you get things clarified.
So clarify. You're telling me I'm here because I want to be?
Of course. Yes.
I choose to be?
Yes.
And I've made that choice many times?
Many.
How many?
Here we go again. You want an exact count?
Just give me a ballpark estimate, huh? I mean, are we talking about handfuls here or dozens?
Hundreds.
Hundreds? I've lived hundreds of lives?
Yes.
And this is as far as I've gotten?
This is quite some distance, actually.
Oh, it is it?
Absolutely. Why, in past lives, you've actually killed people.
What's wrong with that? You said yourself that sometimes war is necessary to end evil.
We're going to have to elaborate on that, because I can see that statement being used and misused, just as you're doing now, to try to make all sorts of points or rationalize all sorts of insanity. By the highest standards I have observed humans devise, killing can never be justified as a means of expressing anger, releasing hostility, righting a wrong, or punishing an offender. The statement that war is sometimes necessary to end evil stands true, for you have made it so. You determine in the creation of self, the respect for all human life is and must be a high prime value. I am pleased with your decision, because I did not create life that it may be destroyed. It is respect for life which sometimes makes war necessary, for it is through war against immediate impending evil, it is through defense against immediate threat to another life, that you make a statement of who you are in relationship to that. You have a right under highest moral law. Indeed, you have an obligation under that law to stop aggression on the person of another or yourself. This does not mean that killing as a punishment is appropriate, nor as retribution, nor as a means of settling petty differences. In your past, you have killed in personal duels over the affection of a woman, for heaven's sake, and called this protecting your honor when it was all honor you were losing. It is absurd to use deadly force as an argument solver. Many humans are still using force, killing force, to solve ridiculous arguments even today. Reaching to the height of hypocrisy, some humans even kill in the name of God, and that is the highest blasphemy, for it does not speak of who you are.
Then there is something wrong with killing.
Let's back up. There's nothing wrong with anything. Wrong is a relative term, indicating the opposite of that which you call right. Yet, what is right? Can you be truly objective in these matters? Or are right and wrong simply descriptions overlaid on events and circumstances by you out of your decision about them? And what, pray tell, forms the basis of your decision? Your own experience? No. Most cases, you've chosen to accept someone else's decision. Someone who came before you and presumably knows better. Very few of your daily decisions about what is right and wrong are being made by you, based on your understanding. This is especially true on important matters. In fact, the more important the matter, the less likely are you to listen to your own experience. The more ready you seem to be to make someone else's ideas your own. This explains why you've given up virtually total control over certain areas of your life and certain questions that arise within the human experience. These areas and questions very often include the subjects most vital to your soul: the nature of God, the nature of true morality, the question of ultimate reality, the issues of life and death surrounding war, medicine, abortion, euthanasia, the whole sum and substance of personal values, structures, judgments. These most of you have abrogated, assigned to others. You don't want to make your own decisions about them. Someone else decide, I'll go along, you shout. Someone else just tell me what's right and wrong. This is why, by the way, human religions are so popular. It almost doesn't matter what the belief system is, as long as it's firm, consistent, clear in its expectation of the follower, and rigid. Given those characteristics, you can find people who believe in almost anything. The strangest behavior and belief can be, has been, attributed to God. It's God's way, they say, God's word. And there are those who will accept that gladly, because, you see, it eliminates the need to think. Now let's think about killing. Can there ever be a justifiable reason for killing anything? Think about it. You'll find you need no outside authority to give you direction, no higher source to supply you with answers. If you think about it, if you look to see what you feel about it, the answers will be obvious to you and you will act accordingly. This is called acting on your own authority. It is when you act on the authority of others that you get yourself into trouble. Should states and nations use killing to achieve their political objectives? Should religions use killing to enforce their theological imperatives? Should societies use killing as a response to those who violate behavioral codes? Is killing an appropriate political remedy, spiritual convincer, or societal problem solver? Now, is killing something you can do if someone is trying to kill you? Would you use killing force to defend the life of a loved one? Someone you didn't even know? Is killing a proper form of defense against those who would kill if they are not in some other way stopped? Is there a difference between killing and murder? The state would have you believe that killing to complete a purely political agenda is perfectly defensible. In fact, the state needs you to take its word on this in order to exist as an entity of power. Religions would have you believe that killing to spread and maintain knowledge of and adherence to their particular truth is perfectly defensible. In fact, religions require you to take their word on this in order to exist as an entity of power. Society would have you believe that killing to punish those who commit certain offenses, these have changed through the years, is perfectly defensible. In fact, society must have you take its word for it in order to exist as an entity of power. Do you believe these positions are correct? Have you taken another's word for it? What does yourself have to say? There is no right or wrong in these matters, but by your decisions you paint a portrait of who you are. Indeed, by their decisions, your states and nations have already painted such pictures. By their decisions, your religions have created lasting, indelible impressions. By their decisions, your societies have produced their self-portraits, too. Are you pleased with these pictures? Are these the impressions you wish to make? Do these portraits represent who you are? Be careful of these questions. They may require you to think. Thinking is hard. Making value judgments is difficult. It places you at pure creation because there are so many times you'll have to say, I don't know, I just don't know. And still you'll have to decide. And so you'll have to choose. You'll have to make an arbitrary choice. Such a choice, a decision coming from no previous personal knowledge, is called pure creation. And the individual is aware, deeply aware, that in the making of such decisions is the self created. Most of you are not interested in such important work. Most of you would rather leave that to others. And so most of you are not self-created, but creatures of habit, other created creatures. Then, when others have told you how you should feel, and it runs directly counter to how you do feel, you experience a deep inner conflict. Something deep inside you tells you that what others have told you is not who you are. Now, where to go with that? What to do? The first place you go is to your religionists, the people who put you there in the first place. You go to your priests and your rabbis and your ministers and your teachers, and they tell you to stop listening to yourself. The worst of them will try to scare you away from it, scare you away from what you intuitively know. They'll tell you about the devil, about Satan, about demons and evil spirits and hell and damnation, and every frightening thing they can think of to get you to see how what you were intuitively knowing and feeling was wrong. And how the only place you'll find any comfort is in their thought, their idea, their theology, their definitions of right and wrong, and their concept of who you are. The seduction here is that all you have to do to get instant approval is to agree. Agree and you have instant approval. Some will even sing and shout and dance and wave their arms and hallelujah. That's hard to resist. Such approval, such rejoicing that you've seen the light, that you've been saved. Approvals and demonstrations seldom accompany inner decisions. Celebrations rarely surround choices to follow personal truth. In fact, quite the contrary. Not only many others fail to celebrate, they may actually subject you to ridicule. What? You're thinking for yourself? You're deciding on your own? You're applying your own yardsticks, your own judgments, your own values? Who do you think you are, anyway? And indeed, that is precisely the question you are answering. But the work must be done very much alone, very much without reward, without approval, perhaps without even any notice. And so you ask a very good question. Why go on? Why even start off on such a path? What is to be gained from embarking on such a journey? Where is the incentive? What is the reason? The reason is ridiculously simple. There is nothing else to do.
What do you mean?
I mean, this is the only game in town. There's nothing else to do. In fact, there's nothing else you can do. You are going to be doing what you are doing for the rest of your life, just as you've been doing it since birth. The only question is whether you'll be doing it consciously or unconsciously. You see, you cannot disembark from the journey. You embarked before you were born. Your birth is simply a sign that the journey has begun. So the question is not, why start off on such a path? You have already started off. You did so with the first beat of your heart. The question is, do I wish to walk this path consciously or unconsciously, with awareness or lack of awareness, as the cause of my experience or as the effect of it? For most of your life, you've lived at the effect of your experiences. Now you're invited to be the cause of them. That is what is known as conscious living. That is what is called walking in awareness. Now, many of you have walked quite some distance, as I've said. You've made no small progress. So you should not feel that after all these lives, you've only come to this. Some of you are highly evolved creatures, with a very sure sense of self. You know who you are, and you know what you'd like to become. Furthermore, you even know the way to get from here to there. That's a great sign. That's a sure indication.
Of what?
Of the fact that you now have very few lives left.
Is that good?
It is, now, for you. And that is so because you say it is so. Not long ago, all you wanted to do was stay here. Now all you want to do is leave. That's a very good sign. Not long ago, you killed things. Bugs, plants, trees, animals, people. Now you cannot kill a thing without knowing exactly what you're doing and why. That's a very good sign. Not long ago, you lived life as though it had no purpose. Now you know it has no purpose, save the one you give it. That's a very good sign. Not long ago, you begged the universe to bring you truth. Now you tell the universe your truth. And that's a very good sign. Not long ago, you sought to be rich and famous. Now you seek to be simply and wonderfully yourself. And not so very long ago, you feared me. Now you love me. Enough to call me your equal. All of these are very, very good signs.
Well, gosh, you make me feel so good.
You should feel good. Anybody who uses gosh in a sentence can't be all bad.
You really do have a sense of humor, don't you?
I invented humor.
Yes, you've made that point. Okay, so the reason for going on is that there's nothing else to do. This is what's happening here.
Precisely.
Then may I ask you, does it at least get any easier?
Oh, my darling friend. It is so much easier for you now than it was 3 lifetimes ago, I can't even tell you. Yes, it does get easier. The more you remember, the more you are able to experience, the more you know, so to speak. The more you know, the more you remember. It is a circle. So yes, it gets easier, it gets better, it becomes even more joyful. But remember, none of it has been exactly a drudge. I mean, you've loved all of it, every last minute. Oh, it's delicious, this thing called life. It's a scrumptious experience, now?
Well, yes, I suppose.
You suppose? How much more scrumptious could I have made it? Are you not being allowed to experience everything? The tears, the joy, the pain, the gladness, the exaltation, the massive depression, the win, the lose, the draw? What more is there?
A little less pain, perhaps.
Less pain without more wisdom defeats your purpose. Does not allow you to experience infinite joy, which is what I am. Be patient. You are gaining wisdom, and your joys are now increasingly available without pain. That, too, is a very good sign. You are learning, remembering how, to love without pain, to let go without pain, to create without pain, to even cry without pain. Yes, you're even able to have your pain without pain, if you know what I mean.
I think I do. I'm enjoying even my own life dramas more. I can stand back and see them for what they are, even laugh.
And you don't call this growth?
I suppose I do.
So then keep on growing, my son. Keep on becoming. And keep on deciding what you want to become in the next highest version of yourself. Keep on working toward that. Keep on. This is God work we're up to, you and I. So keep on.
I love you, you know that?
I know you do. And I love you.
I'd like to get back to my questions. Why can't I ever seem to attract enough money in my life? Am I destined to be forever scrimping and scraping? What's blocking me from realizing my full potential regarding money?
A condition is manifested not just by you, but by a great many people.
Everyone tells me it's a problem of self-worth, a lack of self-worth. I've had a dozen New Age teachers tell me that lack of anything is always traceable to lack of self-worth.
That is a convenient simplification. In this case, your teachers are all wrong. You do not suffer from a lack of self-worth. Indeed, your greatest challenge all your life has been to control your ego. Some have said it's been a case of too much self-worth.
Well, here I am again, embarrassed and chagrined, but you are right.
You keep saying you're embarrassed and chagrined every time I simply tell the truth about you. Embarrassment is the response of a person who still has an ego investment in how others see him. Invite yourself to move past that. Try a new response. Try laughter.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Self-worth is not your problem. You are blessed with an abundance of it. Most people are. You all think very highly of yourself, as rightly you should. So self-worth, for the great mass of the people, is not the problem.
What is?
The problem is lack of understanding of the principles of abundance, together, usually, with a massive misjudgment about what is good and what is evil. Let me give you an example.
Please do.
You carry a thought around that money is bad. You also carry a thought around that God is good. Bless you. Therefore, in your thought system, God and money do not mix.
In a sense, I guess. That's true. That is how I think.
This makes things interesting, because this then makes it difficult for you to take money for any good thing. I mean, if a thing is judged very good by you, you value it less in terms of money. So the better something is, the more worthwhile, the less money it's worth. You are not alone in this. Your whole society believes this. So your teachers make a pittance and your stripteasers a fortune. Your leaders make so little compared to sports figures that they feel they have to steal to make up the difference. Your priests and your rabbis live on bread and water while you throw coins at entertainers. Think about it. Everything on which you place a high intrinsic value, you insist must come cheaply. The lonely research scientist seeking a cure for AIDS goes begging for money, while the woman who writes a book on 100 new ways to have sex and creates tapes and weekend seminars to go with it makes a fortune. This having it all backwards is a propensity with you, and it stems from wrong thought. The wrong thought is your idea about money. You love it, yet you say it is the root of all evil. You adore it, yet you call it filthy lucre. You say that a person is filthy rich. If a person does become wealthy doing good things, you immediately become suspect. You make that wrong. So a doctor had better not make too much money, or had better learn to be discreet about it. And a minister